am the Greek goddess Harmonia. By the miracle of your technology, I can speak to you from behind the veil. Come sit with me for a few minutes for another episode of The Golden Thread. Hello, my friend. Come sit with me a moment. I've been waiting for you. Last time, you'll remember, we walked the back streets of Alexandria with Al-Shadili, a man who found his way to God without ever needing to announce it, tucked in among ordinary merchants and travelers, hiding nothing but making no show of it either. I loved that one. I think you did too. Today we're going somewhere different. Genoa, a port city of stone and salt air, some centuries later, but we're staying close to that same ground, if you understand me. Today's story isn't about someone who left the world behind to find something holy. It's about someone who never left at all, who stayed exactly where she was, in a life she didn't choose, and found God waiting there anyway. I want to show you something first, though. Something strange. Come with me. Picture a small chapel in Genoa, not so long ago. Quiet, the kind of quiet that has settled into the stone over centuries. A handful of people are gathered around a sarcophagus. Not priests, not mourners. Scientists. They have laptops open and cameras on careful stands, and they are speaking to each other in hushed technical murmurs, the way people do when they know they are close to something they don't want to disturb. They are not going to open the casket. That much I understood right away, and I confess it relieved me. Instead, they are photographing what little is visible, feeding those images into machines I do not pretend to understand. Light turned into numbers. Numbers turned into shape. I watched a face begin to gather itself out of nothing, right there on a glowing screen, feature by feature, the way frost gathers on a window before you've noticed it's starting. I'll be honest with you. I found the whole thing dazzling and more than a little bewildering. I have watched a great many strange and wonderful things across a great many centuries, my friend, but I had never before watched a face gather itself back out of 500 years of silence, conjured by nothing you could hold in your hand. Sorcery, I nearly called it, before I remembered that this was simply what your century calls science. But here is what I need you to know, because I was there for the living version, and they were not. They got her. Not perfectly, how could they? A face is more than its bones. But something in the set of it, the quiet steadiness around the eyes, the patience worn into it, that was hers. That was really her. I'd know that face anywhere, in any century, gathered by any means at all. Her name was Catherine. Catherine Fieschi, of Genoa. And I want to tell you how a girl born into one of that city's great noble families ended up 500 years later, still lying in that quiet chapel. Still, in her way, waiting for you too. She was born in 1447, the last of five children, into the Fieschi family, and if you don't know that name, I'll tell you it meant something enormous in Genoa. The Fieschi had given the church two popes. They had wealth, land, ships in the harbor, a seat at every table that mattered. Her father, Jacopo, would go on to become viceroy of Naples. This was not a girl born into obscurity. She was born into weight. The kind of family where a child's future is already spoken for before she's old enough to have opinions about it. And here's the thing I noticed early, watching her as a girl. She wanted none of it. At 13, she asked to enter a convent. She'd watched her older sister Limbania take vows as an Augustinian nun, and something in that quiet, contained life called to her. She was serious about it, serious enough to have her confessor petition the nuns on her behalf. But they turned her away. Too young, they said. And so the way children do, she set the idea aside and didn't try again. I don't think she forgot it, though. I think it stayed folded up somewhere inside her, waiting. Then in 1463, her father died. She was 16. And within that same year, her family arranged her marriage to a young nobleman named Giuliano Adorno. I want you to picture Genoa just then. The Fieschi and the Adorno were old rival families, the kind of rivalry that simmers through generations, spilling into feuds and grudges nobody quite remembers starting. This marriage wasn't about Catherine at all, not really. It was a peace treaty wearing a wedding dress. Giuliano had spent years abroad, trading and soldiering somewhere in the Middle East, and he came home unsettled, restless, not remotely ready to be anyone's husband. Catherine had no real say in any of it. That was simply how it was done. I watched that marriage go wrong almost immediately, and I want to be honest with you about how wrong, because I don't think it does her any good if I soften it. Giuliano was faithless. He had a violent temper. He spent money the family didn't have. There were no children. For the first 5 years, Catherine bore it in silence, a kind of quiet, grinding submission, the sound of a woman making herself smaller so the walls of her life won't feel so close. Then, for another 5 years, something in her gave way, and she turned outward instead, toward the distractions Genoese society could offer a noblewoman with an unhappy home. Parties, company, anything that wasn't the four walls she'd been given. By the 10th year, she was desperate enough to pray for illness. Truly, she asked God for 3 months straight to strike her sick in bed, just so she might have some excuse, some permission, to stop performing the life she'd been handed. I find that detail almost unbearably human. Not a prayer for rescue, not a prayer for faith, a prayer simply to be allowed to stop. It went unanswered. And Catherine kept walking forward into a life that, by every outward measure, had already closed all its doors. But I want you to remember that door at the convent, the one that shut when she was 13. Because doors that close aren't always the end of the story. Sometimes they're just where the story goes quiet for a while, gathering itself, the way that face gathered itself on the screen, waiting for the moment it's ready to come forward again. 10 years into that marriage, in March of 1473, Catherine did something she'd done 100 times before without incident. She went to confession. I remember that morning the way you remember weather before a storm you didn't see coming. Nothing about it announced itself. She knelt in the confessional the way she always had, dutiful, a little worn down, going through motions that had long since stopped meaning very much to her. And then somewhere in the middle of an ordinary sentence, something broke open in her that had nothing to do with the words she was saying. I won't pretend I can explain it to you the way she might have explained it to herself, if she'd ever fully found the words. What I watched was this. A flood. Not a vision. Not a voice. Not any of the theater you might expect from a moment like this. Just an overwhelming, wordless certainty of being loved, entirely and without condition, by something far larger than the four walls of her marriage or the four walls of that confessional. It came so suddenly and so completely that she couldn't finish her sentence. She simply stood up, mid-confession, and walked out of the church, leaving the priest still waiting for the rest of a story she was no longer able to tell. I think that's my favorite detail in her whole life, if I'm honest with you. Not the love itself, though I felt the weight of that too, believe me, but the leaving. Unfinished. Untidy. No neat closing of the ritual. She simply couldn't stay seated a moment longer, and she didn't. Now here's where I need you to notice something. Because it's the whole shape of what makes Catherine's story different from so many others I've told you. In every pattern you might expect, in every story your own imagination has been trained on, a moment like that is followed by withdrawal. The convent, the hermitage, a life set apart from the mess of ordinary obligation so the soul can attend to God undisturbed. Catherine didn't do that. She went home, back to Giuliano, back to the very same unhappy household she'd been praying for years to escape. Nothing about her circumstances changed at all. Not the marriage, not the money troubles, not the noise and grind of an ordinary life in a busy port city. What changed was entirely interior, and she carried it quietly into every one of those same unchanged rooms. She began receiving communion almost daily after that, which I want you to understand was genuinely unusual, almost scandalous for a laywoman of her time. That was a devotion expected of religious, of people who'd set their lives apart for exactly this purpose. Catherine hadn't set her life apart from anything. She was still someone's difficult wife living in someone's difficult house, and now also somehow living in an almost constant wordless communion with God that most cloistered nuns would have envied. I watched her for years after that, and I never once saw her ask to be excused from the ordinary. She didn't ask to be relieved of her marriage, or her circumstances, or the practical grind of her days. She simply carried what had opened in her into exactly the same too small life she'd been given. And somehow the life didn't stay too small any longer. Giuliano's ruin, strange as it sounds, is what finally opened the door the rest of the way. His spending had finally caught up with them. The family fortune was gone, the grand household unsustainable, and somewhere in the wreckage of that, something in him cracked open too. He was converted, in his own way, watching what his wife had quietly become. He didn't become what she was. He'd go on to join the Franciscan tertiaries in his own modest fashion, but he stopped fighting her, and eventually he joined her. Together, they did something I don't think either of their families ever imagined for them. They moved into the Pamatone, Genoa's great charity hospital, and gave themselves to the sick. Not as visitors bringing comfort on occasion, the way nobility sometimes did to ease their conscience, but as residents, as workers. Catherine, in time, became the hospital's manager and treasurer, a woman with her hands in the ledgers, the linens, the daily grinding logistics of feeding and cleaning and burying the poor and the ill of an entire city, most sharply during the plague years that tore through Genoa in 1497 and again in 1501. I want you to sit with that pairing for a moment, because I think it's the heart of everything. A woman in near constant wordless union with God, keeping a hospital's account books by candlelight. Not a saint floating somewhere above the ordinary. A treasurer. A manager, someone counting bandages and coins with the same hands that an hour before had been entirely lost in prayer. There was no dividing line between the two anymore. I looked for one, out of old habit, and I couldn't find it. I've told you a great many stories, my friend, about people who found God by leaving, by walking away from noise, from cities, from the tangled obligations of ordinary life, out into desert silence or mountain solitude, or a cell with one small window. Those are real stories, and I don't take anything away from them. But I've always loved Catherine a little differently, because she never left anything at all. She stayed married to a difficult man. She stayed in a city full of merchants and politics and plague. She kept books. She managed linens and beds and the unglamorous logistics of a hospital that never stopped needing more than it had. And somewhere inside all of that, not instead of it, not despite it, but inside it, she lived as close to God as any hermit I have ever watched in any desert. I think there's a quiet lie that creeps into how people imagine holiness, even now in your century. The lie says, the sacred lives over there, in a temple, in a Sunday, in a retreat, in some future version of your life once the noise finally quiets down. And ordinary life, the job, the marriage that isn't what you hoped, the ledger, the laundry, the endless small obligations. Ordinary life is what you have to get through in the meantime until the real thing starts. Catherine never believed that, or if she did once, she stopped believing it the moment she stood up mid-confession and walked back into exactly the life she already had. She didn't wait for her circumstances to become worthy of what had opened in her. She simply brought what had opened in her into the circumstances she already had. The ledger became a place where God was. The sick bed became a place where God was. Her own imperfect, unchosen marriage became a place where God was, not because any of it transformed into something else, but because she never treated it as separate to begin with. I want to tell you something I've come to understand watching your world as long as I have. Humanity is moving somewhere. Slowly, unevenly, with a great many wrong turns and a great many people doing the quiet, unglamorous work of it without ever being noticed, but moving, all the same, towards something more whole than it's ever managed before. I don't know exactly what road gets you there. There are more roads than I could count, and every generation finds new ones. But I've come to trust that the arrival is not in question, even when the path is. And here is what Catherine understood. Centuries before most people caught up to her, that work isn't done somewhere else. It isn't done by better people, in more spiritual circumstances, once the ordinary parts of life have been cleared out of the way. It's done in ledgers, in sick rooms, in marriages that aren't what you dreamed of, in the account books of your own unremarkable Tuesday. Believing in where humanity is headed was never enough for her. She put her hands into the actual unglamorous work of it. Right where she already stood. That's the part I want you to carry with you. Not the mystical flood, though it was real and I felt it too, but the treasurer's ledger afterward, the staying, the refusal to treat her real life as something separate from her real faith. She never went looking for a holier place to stand. She simply noticed that she was already standing in one. So let me ask you something before we close. Where in your own life have you quietly decided the sacred doesn't live? Maybe it's your job. Something you do to get by. Nothing more. A place you clock into and count the hours until you can leave. Maybe it's a relationship that isn't what you hoped it would be, one you've stopped expecting much from. Maybe it's just the errands, the emails, the dishes, the traffic, all the parts of your day you've quietly filed under not it, waiting for some other better hour to arrive before anything real can happen. Catherine never got that better hour. Her marriage didn't improve. Her circumstances didn't change. She didn't get to leave the ledgers for a mountaintop. And I don't say that to be discouraging, my friend. I say it because I want you to notice what she did instead. She stopped waiting for an exit, and she looked instead for what was already alive in the room she was standing in. I'm not asking you to love what's difficult in your life, or to pretend it doesn't ask hard things of you. I'm only asking you to wonder for a moment whether the door you've been waiting to walk through might already be open, right where you are. Whether the ledger, the ordinary Tuesday, the unglamorous work of your own life might already be the place, not the waiting room before the place. I don't know the answer for you. I'm not sure Catherine could have told you either, not in so many words. She just stopped waiting one morning mid-sentence and stood up and went home. Next time, I want to take you to Constantinople, centuries before Catherine, in a city of gold mosaics and imperial intrigue. I want to tell you about a woman named Cassia, brought before an emperor at a bride show of all things, where beautiful young women were paraded like prizes for him to choose from. He looked at her and said something cutting about women and sin, and instead of staying silent the way she was surely meant to, she answered him back, sharp and unflinching, right there in front of the court. He chose someone else. She lost a crown that day, but she didn't lose her voice. She went on to write hymns. Hymns still sung in churches to this day, nearly 12 centuries later, one of them so raw and unguarded it's said to have moved an emperor to tears on his own deathbed, remembering the woman he'd once turned away. I can't wait to tell you that one. For now, though, I want to leave you with Catherine, a treasurer's ledger open under candlelight, a woman who never went looking for a holier room to stand in because she'd stopped believing one existed apart from the room she was already in. Her body still lies quiet in that Genoa chapel, 500 years on, still teaching that same lesson to anyone patient enough to sit with her a while. Wherever you're standing right now, my friend, I suspect it's already holier than you think. Much love. I am Harmonia. Oh, thank you for listening, dear one. If this episode meant something to you, I'd love it if you'd leave a 5-star rating. It helps more people find their way here. And if you subscribe, you will never miss a thread and share this story with someone you love. One more thing, my friend, look in your episode notes. There's a link there that leads back to our little community. Leave a comment. I promise. I read every one. This podcast sails out to you from Red Buoy Media, LLC. The stories we share are licensed under Creative Commons Attribution, non-commercial, share-alike 4.0 international. That means you can pass them along, remix them, and even argue with them. Just give us credit, don't try to sell them, and share responsibly. Thanks for listening, friend. Until our next adventure.